Perek Beis, Pasuk Tes Zayin. Pasuk tells us, L'hatzilcha me'isha zara. Zara. You might notice this phrase from another pasuk that we've seen, if you don't have a Mishlei in front of you, but if you would, look at Yud Bet, so you'll see, L'hatzilcha miderech ra. So here it's saying, to save you from a foreign woman, and before it said, to save you from a evil way. And then it says in that pasuk in Yud Bet, "Me'ish midaber tavuchos," from a person, from a man who would speak the opposite. Right? He'd say one thing and it really means the other thing. And here it's saying, "L'hatzilcha me'isha zara." Right? From now we're talking about a woman who might be persuading you to do the wrong thing. So then the pasuk continues, "Minachria amareha hechalika." What's minachria? Like a nachri?
A non-Jewish
woman. A nachri in Gemara terms means non-Jewish woman. But in this term, it really also means foreigner. So then we have to figure out, what is the difference between a zara and a nachriya? So what would you think is the difference? Any, one's what? No, I guess maybe, possibly. It's possible that would be the case. It's just... A forbidden woman is not an alien. You mean a Nachriya is an alien and a Zara is...
Another nation. The forbidden woman could be someone who's an Erva.
Okay, yeah, Banana.
Wouldn't Nachriya be more banal and Zara is like a Vodazara, like something really...
Okay, so some people point that out, that Zara is like, a Vodazara is like an ideological difference. The foreign, the nature of its unfamiliarity, the foreignness of the situation is the ideology. As opposed to a nachriya is not an ideological difference, but a geographical difference. That this is a woman you've never seen before. You don't know her from a hole in the wall. The Isha Zara, you're very well attuned to. You've seen her around. You know what she's all about. So the Malvim, or the Radak points out that the Isha Zara means someone who's clearly evil. Someone who's clear and everybody knows she's doing the wrong thing. That kind of person will try to sway you, will try to convince you. And that's the type of person you have to be saved from. L'hatzilcha mi'isha zara. But then it's minachriya, from a woman from coming from the outside. Someone who you don't recognize. You don't really know what she's all about. It's not clear and obvious that she's on the wrong side of something. And that's why it says, amareha hechalika. What does hechalika mean? Anyone ever heard of the term chalak meat? No? Chalak meat is basically the Sephardi term for glot. Anyone know what glot means?
Smooth.
Have you ever heard I think Sephardi is called the haircut. A chalaka. You ever heard of chalaka? Like the upsharon is Yiddish, but chalaka in Hebrew. It means a smoothening out. Right? You're taking away some of the bumps. So here, her speech is very slick. She's a very smooth talker. Amareha hechalika, that the way that she approaches things is not in terms of saying, I'm doing the wrong thing, come join me, come over to the dark side, but rather she masks it. She disguises it as if it's the good thing, as if it's the right thing to do, and really she is really being deceitful, or deceiving, I should say. And we've seen this before. Right? This is exactly what the pasuk we just quoted. L'hatzilcha miderech ra, me'ish medaber tapuchos. From the man who's saying one thing but really means the opposite. Right? So this is one of the sort of parallels between certain parts of Mishlei. But what's interesting is, this is a woman and that was a man. So what's the difference? The woman obviously has a different connotation. What's the connotation of a woman who might be persuading you? It's more of a Gilui Arayos type of appeal. Right? It's kind of more of a desirous, appealing to your desires and not as much to your intellect. Whereas the man might have been more trickery in the intellect, the woman might be more trickery, more tricky in her appeal, physically maybe. I don't know. And then you'll notice that there's another connection. If you would look back at Yud Gimel, it says, Ha'ozvim Archos Yosher, that those men that are tricking you are ones that leave the straight path. To go in the dark path, the dark way. And then here it says also, ha'ozevet, she is the one who leaves. Another leaving. They left the straight and narrow. And here, she's what? Ozeves aluf ne'ureha. What does aluf ne'ureha mean? What's ne'ureha? Anyone know what's na'ar, na'ara?
Youth.
A youth. What's aluf? Aluf can mean different things. One habit?
No,
a rabbi.
Yeah.
Why do you think that? Yeah, so sometimes aluf means a leader of some kind. Here, if you look at Rashi, if I have the source here. Oh, I've already skipped something. But Rashi explains to us what aluf is. Well, let's go back for a second. The Radak had said that Zara means someone who's obviously evil. And Nachria means someone who is obviously, who is from a different place. Not so obvious what she is. And we had mentioned this before, also, if you remember, from the Vilna Gaon, who said, Nitzor Lashon Chameira Usfasech Medaber Mirma, that the Lashon is part of the person's essence. The person is just a bad person. And that's why it's Nitzor Lashon Chameira. So keep away from your essence being evil. But then this Usfasech Medaber Mirma, that your lips, which are only on the outside, are speaking trickery. Either way, same distinction here that we said before. But what's interesting about this that I wanted to bring out was the religious component to it. Because the truth is that we talked last time about a person that was trying to convince you to do the wrong thing. Here, it's not necessarily clear that we're talking about refraining from the woman as much as this is really an analogy. Maybe it's some kind of analogy of staying away from promiscuous women. And some explain that this is really an analogy for the Torah. That it's not, or as Badana was saying before, it's not just an Isha Zara, but Isha Zara is emblematic of Avodah Zara. That she, this woman, represents a certain appeal of other beliefs, of foreign beliefs, of beliefs that we're not supposed to believe in. So if you understand that way, and I think I forget who I saw that says it. I think the Gra might have said that there it's really a foreign belief that we're trying to stay away from. So then we really have to understand how it is. Oh, Rashi said it. Rashi says, Isha Zara Miknesia shall apikarsus. Vihi haminus velo yitachin lomar. Fine. So Rashi, there's a reason Rashi says this, that he feels like it has to be said, but we'll get into it a different time. But Rashi says here, this is referring to not getting along or getting buddy-buddy with heretics and people that are telling you the wrong things. So if we're going to understand that, so now let's plug in the Radak into a religious context. Right, so we said the Radak said there are two types of women. The ones that are obviously wrong, and then the ones that are going to trick you into doing the wrong thing. So if you now interpret that, according to Rashi, into a religious aspect and religious elements, so then what do you have? You have a religious component, which is maybe a religion that's completely off base, which you know is obviously wrong. But that religion is going to try to convert you. That religion is going to send missionaries to your house. That religion is going to hand out pamphlets. They're going to try to convert you to their belief system. But you know it's wrong. But you still have to be saved from that temptation or from the appeal of whatever they promote. But then there's another type of religious appeal. And that is within your own religion. That within Judaism, there might be people that promote a certain thing under the umbrella of Judaism. They might quote sources, they might quote psukim, and yet really in the essence of it, it's not really Judaism. They're sort of abusing or manipulating the sources in order to teach you what they want Judaism to tell you. And it's not necessarily the case that they're right. So that's the corollary, according to this, to the Isha Zara, which is clearly not your religion, is clearly not Judaism, versus a Nachriya, which comes from another place, but you can't necessarily distinguish that it's very different from yourself, from the religion you have. And that reminded me of a very interesting, another analogy that the Rambam tells us in Mor Nevuchim. Mor Nevuchim, as you know, is a philosophical work that he really says he wrote for one student, but was obviously geared towards many students because no one writes a 500-page book to one student.
You had to handwrite it.
Right, and you're handwriting it, yeah. So, but what's interesting is that it was written in Arabic. Oftentimes I like to bring you the original source material. In this case, I am not going to because it wouldn't help us. But that's why I bring you the English without any Hebrew. Some people feel the need to read the Mor Nevuchim in Hebrew. I personally don't because that wasn't the way he wrote it either. So what's the, I guess speaking Hebrew is always an advantage, but whatever. So he says the following. This is called, I think it's known as the palace analogy. Anyone familiar with the palace analogy? The Rambam is very big on understanding people's, I don't want to say lot in life, although there are some parts of it that sound like that. The people's standing in terms of the religious achievements based on their understanding of God. Whatever that means, in the Rambam's own words, in the Rambam's own concept. So he says the following. I will begin the subject of this chapter with a simile. A king is in his palace, and all his subjects are partly in the country, and partly abroad. Whenever you have a Jewish analogy that is surrounding a king, you know who the king is. So that's an easy start, right? Of the former, you don't know. I'll have to figure it out. Of the former, some have their backs turned towards the king's palace and their faces in another direction. And some are desirous and zealous to go to the palace, seeking to inquire in his temple and to minister before him, but have not yet seen even the face of the wall of the house. Of those that desire to go to the palace, some reach it and go round about in search of the entrance gate. Others have passed through the gate and walked about in the antechamber. And others have succeeded in entering into the inner part of the palace and begin in the same room with the king in the royal palace. But even the latter do not immediately, on entering the palace, see the king or speak to him. For after having entered the inner part of the palace, another effort is required before they can stand before the king at a distance or close by, hear his words, or speak to him. I will now explain the simile which I have made. It's somewhat understood, but there's one point in it which is not necessarily obvious, and that's why we want to read it together. The people who are abroad are all those who have no religion, neither one based on speculation, nor one received by tradition. Such, says the Rambam, these are somewhat harsh words, and I checked the Hebrew is the same, I didn't check the Arabic because it wouldn't be worthwhile. Such are the extreme Turks that wander about in the north, the Kushites who live in the south, and those in our country, Spain, maybe Egypt, who are like these. I consider these as irrational beings and not as human beings. They are below mankind, but above monkeys, since they have the form and shape of man and a material mental faculty above that of the monkey. Pretty harsh words for atheists. That's what it seems like, at least. The Rambam did not hold any punches when he was speaking out against people, clearly. But then he says, yeah, what were you going to say?
It's interesting that he says that about those who have no religion.
No religion.
He doesn't make any comment about people who have the wrong religion.
That's true. That's true. There is an interesting Rambam that is oftentimes censored from many versions of the Mishneh Torah, which seems to say that Yishmaelim have a certain truth to them because of their monotheistic perspective, as opposed to Christianity, which may or may not be, depending on which Rishon you read that day. But he has a point there where he talks about Yishmaelim being closer to the truth, not obviously fully truth, but closer to it. Then he also has an Igeres Teiman, where he talks to Yemen about the perils of Islam and stuff like that. But at least he believes that they're not Avodah Zarah, that they have a certain stake in the heavens, because I don't remember exactly his lashon, but he says that they have a certain semblance of truth. But he doesn't. It's an interesting point. He doesn't point out a specific religion when he says that. Only no religion, because at least the other people are thinking about religion. They have a notion of God, whatever. But maybe that's connected to the next part. So we have the people that are on the outside. They're abroad, they're outside of the temple. Those who are in the country but have their backs turned to their king's palace are those who possess religion, belief, and thought, but happen to hold false doctrines. Very interesting lashon, very interesting way to say it. They happen to hold false doctrines, not by any fault of their own, but they happen to have falsehood. They just happen to have it. How? Which they either adopted in consequence of great mistakes made in their own speculations, or received from others who misled them. Maybe Christianity. He might be talking about a whole bunch of things here. It's unclear. That they have somehow they got the wrong message. Because of these doctrines, they recede more and more from the royal palace the more they seem to proceed. They think the more that they learn, the better off they are. But really, in actuality, they're going further and further away from the palace. And then he says the following. These, the second group, who are inside the country, but are going away from the palace, these are worse than the first class. Worse than the first class, who are even outside of the country. And under certain circumstances, it may become necessary to day them. I don't know if that's a typo or not. It seems like a typo. And to extirpate their doctrines in order that the others should not be misled. Why does he say these are more dangerous than the others? Because the other ones clearly are in a different world. They're completely, you know, non-religious. They don't hold any beliefs similar to ours. It's clear and obvious that they have the wrong message. They have the wrong perspective. But the people that are in the country, the people that live in the king's country, seem like they've got the right message. Seem like maybe they're living in the right place. And yet, the further they move out, the more other people will see them and be drawn towards them. Because they're living in the country. And if they're living in the country and going the wrong direction, so why can't we, who also live in the country, go in that direction? So the Rambam says, it might be true that the people on the outside of the country are further away, but the people that are inside the country can very well be much more dangerous. And this is presumably what we're talking about here, the Radak. The Isha Zara is an ideological difference, but it's an obvious ideological difference. But the Nachriya Amara HaChalika, the woman who's a foreigner, but doesn't necessarily look it, and is a smooth talker, she's much more dangerous. Because you can't necessarily distinguish between truth and untruth. And everyone has their own connections to this in their modern day lives, and everyone knows someone who's way off and someone who's closer to it, but misguided, and we should all take the necessary precautions. But this is what the pasuk is talking about. L'hatzil chamisha zara, minachriya amareha chalika. Two types of appeals that might be dangerous. And then the pasuk says, ha'ozevas aluf na'oreha, ve'as bris eloheha shachecha. So what does it mean? She has left the companion of her youth. This is understanding aluf as just a companion or a husband or a spouse or whatever. V'yes bris eloheha shachecha. And disregards, or literally forgets, the covenant of her God. So my big question on this pasuk when I read it was, why do we need to know it? Why do we need to know it? What is Shlomo HaMelech's purpose in this whole parsha, in this whole section? Is that when you come to a person like this, make sure your guard is up. Make sure you're thinking critically. Make sure you don't get persuaded in the wrong direction. So what does it matter what she used to do in her youth? What does it matter that it once was the time where she had aluf nu'reha and she left it, and now she forgot her bris elokah?
She's from the second group.
What do you mean?
She's from the second group. She used to be knowledgeable.
Okay.
And now she's using her
knowledge. Okay, but why does that help me right now? Right? So the Shlomo HaMelech is saying, when you approach a person, when you encounter a person like this, don't be persuaded. Don't be convinced. Don't be, you know, led astray. What does it matter what she used to do? I have to deal with it right now.
Maybe,
yeah.
Though, that's going to be part of her tactic.
Okay, what do you mean?
She knows enough to know.
Uh-huh. I mean, once upon a time, maybe this was a conscious decision that she made. And Leonard is saying, so you should know she's going to have strategies. She's going to have missionary strategies, tactics, in order to persuade you. Presentations of some kind that she used in her youth in order to show people, you know, to that led her astray, that's also going to lead you astray. Yeah, Michael?
She came from where we were before. She is going to present things that are familiar and comfortable to you that are going to make you relax.
Meaning she has a certain familiarity with the previous. So that's what Michael was saying before. Okay. That she's the tricky one because she knows the material, right? As opposed to someone who doesn't know.
Talk,
yeah. Right. Shana?
Maybe companion for you is referring to like tradition or
right. So maybe it's within the analogy again, right? It's not a literal woman necessarily, but it's talking about the concepts of the Torah that she knows. And she's then going to, I guess, use that to manipulate the sources, as we were saying, Amara HaChalika. But I wanted to potentially propose a different understanding. And that is within the concept of, I thought I had written it here. Oh, I wrote it later. That to know that her misguidance is childlike. What do I mean by that? When she approaches you, and she's going to presenting her whole schmooze, she's going to give you the whole presentation. So you should know, this is a woman that was Ozeves Aluf Ne'ureha, that she was someone who acted child in her youth. She left her, it's not necessarily, you can interpret otherwise in the Pasuk, but she left her companion in her youth, meaning she made an ill-gotten decision with her youthful brain, her sort of her immature brain, that she was, you know, she sought after the wrong things because she was too young to understand the real thing. So when you see someone who's misguided, you should know they're still acting immature. That this whole construct that they've built up for themselves is really an immature construct, and don't buy into it. It's really just an appeal to your desires, it's an appeal to your emotional side, just like she was appealed to when she was younger. That's one possibility. Perhaps the better possibility is, and this is also a similar concept to what I just said, that aluf ne'ureha means that she's someone who, like a child, always goes after the new shiny toy. Right? The ha'ozeves aluf ne'ureha means that just like she left her first husband, she left her first spouse, she's going to leave you too. Right? When she comes and she sells you this whole thing, the whole story about whatever she wants you to do with her and whatever, you know, life you'll lead together, you should know, ozeves aluf ne'ureha. She did this before, and then she dumped him like a hot potato. Right? So don't think that she's selling you this whole this bag of goods where you're going to have this beautiful life together. She's just tricking you. And obviously, more importantly, is the nimshal, is the analogy piece of this, which is that oftentimes you'll find a new way of, you know, presenting Judaism, or a new way of presenting a morality, which might feel very nice, it might feel very comfortable based on the culture's modern norms. Right? Nowadays, with all the laws and all the political sways, maybe you're going to be tempted to follow an interpretation of Judaism which is more in line with those cultural norms. And it's going to feel good. But you know what? Ozeves aluf ne'ureha. There used to be another type of Judaism that was also Hellenized, or that was also assimilated, that was also acculturated to different norms and different mores that once upon a time also led people astray. And you should know she's going to do the same thing to you. If you follow, if you try to, you know, shoehorn your Jewish beliefs into the modern culture, you're also going to be left behind. Right? And you can apply this to the reform movement, you can apply the conservative movement, you can see just in the statistics how all of the movements that once were supposed to be the future of Judaism with a new modern twist, a new modern perspective, they've all been left in the dust. They've all become basically diluted to the extent that they have to keep changing all of their rules in order to make sure that their movement continues. And part of the mission that we have is to realize that ozeves aluf ne'ureha, whenever you have this newfound love, this newfound culture that you think would be a nice thing to incorporate into your Judaism, remember this, that it will not work out in the end, that she's going to leave you too. And that's presumably, that's potentially another understanding of this, of the reason why this pasuk is here, ozeves aluf ne'ureha, to warn you that this new thing might not be something you want to be engaged with. But the truth is that we all understand this in one way or another from just being around teenagers, right? Ozeves aluf ne'ureha, that when you have, and this works better with the interpretation that aluf means some kind of guide or some kind of leader. The truth is the Malbim says, if you look at source number three, the source number four, or the Metzudas David says, first that aluf ne'ureha means baal ne'ureha, that it means her spouse. And then he says in Metzudas Tzion al Mishlei, aluf means sar. Sar is an officer. He then says at the end of Virotza Lomar Habal, which doesn't really equate with Sar, but a Sar usually means an officer. And what is he quoted from? Tehillim Nun Hei. Does anyone know? What Tehillim are we up to in davening? Tehillim Nun Hei. If you look at the back sign back there, we keep a running tally of what Tehillim Perek we say every single day at davening. And at Mincha today, we just said Nun Dalet. Certain siyata d'shmaya for our shir to recognize that Hashem is watching over us and hopefully giving us koach. So here, what does it mean? Sar, like David HaMelech, like Shlomo HaMelech says, alufi umiyudai. Probably David HaMelech, if I had to guess based on the different parakim that we're doing now. David HaMelech says, alufi umiyudai, my guides, my mentors. So what does it mean? Ha'ozeves aluf ne'ura, that she leaves the mentors of her youth, just like every teenager we know. That when they get too wrapped up with their emotions, and they don't have the necessary intellectual capacity that an adult has, oftentimes they get swayed and persuaded into different ways of thinking, into different really behaviors that aren't as good for them because they can't necessarily distinguish between what's right and what's wrong based on their emotional pulls. And it's just not, it's not a huge chiddush, but just a little bit of the psychology behind that in source number 5. I found this from a textbook. During adolescence, the brain continues to form new neural connections, but also casts off unused neurons and connections. So why do I bring that part of the that part of the textbook? Because if you read the last part of the pasuk, what did it said? V'yasbris Eloheha shachecha. It's not just that she disregards like this translation. Shachecha means she literally forgot it. How did she forget it? Because she was so busy, you know, being persuaded into her emotional side that she literally forgot what she knew to be true. And this is the same during adolescence. The brain continues to form new neural connections, but also casts off unused neurons and connections. She completely forgot about them. She literally, shachecha, she forgot them. Adolescents often seem to act impulsively. I don't know if anyone knows here adolescents, but maybe you were one once upon a time. But adolescents often seem to act impulsively rather than thoughtfully. And this may be, in part, because the development of the prefrontal cortex is, in general, slower than the development of the emotional parts of the brain, including the limbic system, meaning our emotional side develops quicker than our intellectual side. I remember when I had surgery on my arm when I was a teenager, so I had one of these somewhat, you know how doctors, surgeons get, they're a little egotistical. So he says, you know these teenagers, I'm sitting right there, and he says, you know these teenagers, their prefrontal lobes haven't fully developed. So you make sure that he does his stretches, and you make sure he stays in a cast, and you make sure, whatever. And I'm like, okay, I get it. Like, you think I'm an idiot. I get it. But this is what this article is saying, right? That the development of prefrontal cortex is in general slower than the development of the emotional parts of the brain. That our desires oftentimes overcome our intellectual knowledge that we know to be true. The new cognitive, and this next part I find really interesting. I'm not sure how true it is to all teenagers, but maybe some of you have better firsthand knowledge of it. The new cognitive abilities that are attained during adolescence may also give rise to new feelings of egocentrism, in which adolescents believe that they can do anything and that they know better than anyone else, including
their parents.
It was over the page, so you guys all got to predict what it was going
to
say.
This is limited to adolescence.
Not necessarily, but it's the newfoundness of these capacities is particularly ripe for this pitfall. Right. Teenagers are likely to be highly self-conscious, often creating an imaginary audience in which they feel that everyone is constantly watching them. Because teens think so much about themselves, they mistakenly believe that others must be thinking about them too. It is no wonder that everything a teen's parents do suddenly feels embarrassing to them when they're in public. Because everything's about them. And if someone sees their parent doing this, it's going to reflect bad on them. And everyone's watching. And they have this certain emotional immaturity that is overcoming their sort of better judgment. And perhaps that's another understanding of here. Ha'ozeves aluf ne'ureha. That she leaves the mentors of her youth because they try to create their own independence. They try to separate from other people because of their development, their egocentric development as ne'ureha when they're in their youth. So perhaps that's another connotation of what's going on here. And then, for some reason, we have very morbid warnings about what this woman will do to you. Why should you stay away from this woman? Or why must the wisdom save you from this woman? Kishacha el maves besa. Because her house sinks down to death. Anyone know the word shacha? Where's the word shacha from? I think I'm right about this. I haven't checked it, but that's actually an interesting point. Yeah, shin ches taf usually means to destroy. What? Lahashchid, right, like Baal Tashchis. That would be an interesting connection, although it doesn't say that here. Maybe sinks down is part of destruction. Maybe that's right. I was thinking it might be connected to the word Lahishtachavot, to bow. Hishtachava. Right, those letters in the middle are throwaway letters. But shachah could mean to bow down, that the house is sinking towards death. What does that mean? Because she's doing all these promiscuous things. Or in the analogy, they're believing in all these, you know, these false ideas that you're going to go towards death, meaning your life is going to be worthless. And then it says, Ve'el rifa'im ma'aglosah. And two rifa'im are her cycles. Over here it says, and her course leads to the shades. I have no idea what that means. But rifa'im may be a synonym for maves in this situation. Some of the mafarshim sound like that. But rafoi yadayim. Anyone ever heard of rafoi yadayim? Rifyon yadayim? Weak, okay, right, close. What literally rifyon means? Like rifidim. Like when the Jewish people, Bayitsumi rifidim, Bayavo, Midbar Sinai, they left rifyon yadayim, they left a looseness of their hands, and they came to Har Sinai. Rifyon, rifaim, might mean looseness. That there's a looseness to her cycle. What does that mean, her cycle? We've actually seen this word before. What is a ma'agala?
Circle.
A circle, like an igul. That is in contradistinction to what word that we said last week?
Yashar.
Yashar means straight. Ma'agal means circle. And the Ma'abim had said, sometime you have to get off the path in order to reprimand other people, in order to get back on the path, in order to motivate other people, influence other people to get onto the path. So here, what does it say? Rif el rifaim ma'agloseha. Her circular and windy paths that will lead you to a looseness. What does it mean, to a looseness? So there are two possibilities, and the Ma'abim sort of alludes to both of them. A looseness could be one from the Torah, which is sort of the obvious understanding, which is that when you follow her path, her windy path, you're going to be sort of you're gonna lose. It's gonna be like sand, quicksand in your hands. It's just gonna fall right through. You're gonna lose all of the Torah. It's gonna become loose in your hand. You're not gonna be able to remember. You're not gonna be able to hold to it, etc. The other possibility is El Rifaim Magloseha, that even her own cycle, even her own paths, will end up being loose. You ever find someone who's trying to sell you something? And it doesn't make any sense. And the more they talk about it, it makes less and less sense. You ever meet those people? Or meet those kinds of missionaries that are trying to sell you something, and it just doesn't make any sense. And the more questions you ask, the more it doesn't make any sense. So here, perhaps, what it's saying, I think the Malvim alludes to this also, El Rifaim Ma'agloseha means that you're going to go down her path. And you're going to get further and further down your path. We'll see what comes of that soon. But you should know that path, even the path itself, will become very loose. It'll start to unravel, to crumble. She'll sell you this whole, or in the analogy, you'll be sold this entire religion or this set of beliefs, and sooner or later it'll all just crumble, right? If we're going to really go full steam on the conservative and reform path, in order to understand this. So perhaps you can understand this by saying, they started one thing, and then just keep going and going and going. And then, El Rifaim Agloseha, that literally, it just diluted and diluted more and more until the beliefs are very, very loose. Right? Two years ago, I was on a panel in Kansas. It was me, a Reform rabbi, and a conservative rabbi, speaking to the city conversion class. Very nice idea. That the whole city, the Jewish Federation funds this, or really the Rabbinic Association sort of gives a class every week to people that are looking to convert into Judaism. And as you think, and all the rabbis are on a rotation to teach, and some Orthodox rabbis don't like teaching because most of the converts that are going to this class are obviously not Orthodox. Because if you're going to be learning from a Reform and Conservative rabbi, so then you're obviously going to get things that the Orthodox don't need. But other streams of Judaism might not have as big of a problem with learning from an Orthodox rabbi. So either way, I'm sort of I like to be nice to, I like to create, you know, positive relationships. So I wanted to be involved in this, and I wanted to give them at least a sense of true Judaism. So the first thing I ever did was this panel, these other conservative and this other Reform rabbi, and it was really one of the first classes. So at that time, there was still someone in the class that was Orthodox that didn't really know they shouldn't be there yet. So we go around and everyone's asking all these questions, and I guess this Orthodox guy happens to be that he was dating this other girl who was Orthodox, and he just came along for the ride because he was what we call a datlash. Anyone know the concept, the term datlash? It's basically the Israeli version of off the derech. It stands for Dati L'Sha'avar. Used to be from. Now he's Baruch Hashem coming back to Frumkite through this girl, whatever. Long story. But he was there, and he's Israeli, and as you can imagine, he's not holding any punches. And he says to the Reform Rabbi, I don't get it. Do you just pick and choose what mitzvot you do? And this was literally the response of the Reform Rabbi. The Reform Rabbi says, I guess, but I wouldn't say it like that. That's what he says. I guess, but I wouldn't say it like that. And then I sort of step in and I say, Rabbi, I think what you mean to say is that we have certain overarching principles that outweigh other principles, like derachah darachinoam, you know, that the Torah is supposed to be nice, and if there's a halacha we don't like, so then that one outweighs it. And he's like, yeah, that's a better way to say it. So I came to the rescue of the Reform. But what it means basically is that anything goes as long as there's another sort of competing principle, which is an overarching value that they think is more important. But that's what we find here. Rifa'im magloseha means that it could be that this cycle of going down this path, of incorporating other ideas or finding different meanings in different psukim, will lead you down to a path where the ma'agal itself, that the path they went on itself will become loose and will no longer lead you down in the right direction. And then the next pasuk says, kol ba'eha lo yishuvun. Anyone who goes down that path, they're not coming back, right? Anyone who goes doesn't come back, right? You've heard that in books and stories and stuff like that, right? So this is from Shlomo HaMelech. Kol ba'eha lo yishuvun. Anyone who goes down that path, we never hear from them again, right? It's like the sandlot. When they go, there's this one boy that once tried to get a ball, we never heard from him again, right? So there's kol ba'eha lo yishuvun. They never come back. And they will never comprehend the true path of life. What does that mean? Says the Malbim. Kol negin mashikaz v'kishacha amavas beisa amar kol ba'el lo yishuvun. Shehabal habayis lo yishuv misham od. Anyone who goes into that house, they never come out. Od kiyamus, because they're going to die. That's what it means. That kol kishacha el maves beisa. That anyone who goes into their house, they end up dying. And in terms of the looseness of the path that we just mentioned, Amar kiloya sigo archos chaim shaloyedame kamagal acher shayde haderech aguli yashuv al haorech hayashar. That through this cycle, that this windy path, as we said from the Malbim last week, when you're not going straight, you're going curve, you're going all around. So what it's saying here, lo yashuv al haorech hayashar. This windy path will never find the straight path again. It is so far into the woods that you'll never be able to find your way back. And that's what he says. It means, kol ba'eha lo yishuvun, you'll never find the path again. Ki min ha-ma'agal hazeh lo yasigu archos chaim. Because this kind of path will never truly comprehend the truth of life, the true path of life. And this, I don't know the song, but I'm sure there's a good quote in there for me. But this reminded me of, you'll never leave? Oh, okay. That was it? Okay. This reminded me of a fascinating commercial, and I never saw it on TV, but people know of it because it was this very interesting commercial that that went viral online. It was a commercial for bicyclists, and oftentimes if you're driving a car, maybe you don't see the bicyclist as well. So this commercial goes. Anyone ever heard this? I don't know what it's called. Test your mind or something. Gorilla in your midst. You ever seen this? The basketball, right? Yeah, the basketball. So they set up a team, and they're all passing the ball back and forth, and you're supposed to count how many times they pass the ball. And then in the middle of it, there's a gorilla dancing. There are different versions of it. There's a waving, and there's a moonwalking. There are different versions. People did different funny ones. But anyone who watches it never sees the gorilla. Why not? Because they're so fixated on the ball and the passing and the counting that they completely miss a gorilla dancing in the middle of the screen. So this is the same thing, right? This path is so windy. It is going to get your perspective on life so down a rabbit hole, you will never find your way back. You'll never be able to see lo yasigu archos yoshar. Archos Chaim. You'll never be able to comprehend the true path of life because you'll be so fixated on whatever they said, you can't even reprogram your mind in the moment. And the Malbim actually goes even further to say, Gam Yesh Lefari Shirot Zolomar, in source number 7, Kol Ba'eha Lo Yeshuvan Ol B'tshuva. All of these people, they will never come back and do tshuva. V'gam im yashuvu lo yasigu od archos chayim. Even if they try to do tshuva, and they do tshuva, they'll never truly comprehend. This is how far the Malbim says. If you take one of these missionary statements, if you go down this path, and you truly believe all the things that they're saying, you'll never truly be able to recalibrate your mind. You'll never truly be able to reset. You'll always have a little bit, he says, a se'or shebi isa. There's always going to be a little bit there that's going to give a tinge to the way you look at life. I don't know people that well to understand that, but that's what the Malbim says. Lo yitzigu archos chaim ever. Even if you are yashuv, even if you do tshuva, you'll never truly understand it. Hard thing to say. But this source number 8 is basically, it's named after that experiment, and it goes through the concept of inattentional blindness, meaning the fact that you're blind to something because you're not paying attention to it, but not because you're chas v'shalom blind. With each eye fixation, we experience a richly detailed visual world. Yet recent work on visual integration and change direction reveals that we are surprisingly unaware of the details of our environment from one view to the next. We often do not detect large changes to objects and scenes, meaning change blindness. Furthermore, without attention, we may not even perceive objects. We may not even perceive objects, meaning in an inattentional blindness. Taken together, these findings suggest that we perceive and remember only those objects and details that we receive focused attention. That have received, I don't know. That receive focused attention. In this paper, we briefly review and discuss evidence for these cognitive forms of blindness. We then present a new study that builds on classic studies of divided visual attention to examine inattentional blindness for complex objects and events in dynamic scenes, which I guess is a reference to that commercial. Our results suggest that the likelihood of noticing an unexpected object depends on the similarity of that object to other objects in the display and how difficult the priming monitoring task is. Interestingly, spatial proximity of the critical unattended object to the attended locations does not appear to affect the detection, suggesting that observers attend to objects and events, not spatial positions, meaning that gorilla was right next to the basketball players, right? It wasn't like it was off in the corner of the screen. It was literally right next to them. We discussed the implications of these ritual results for visual representations and awareness of our visual environment. Fascinating sort of inattentive blindness, yeah. Ah, that's a very good point. So there's machlokas over there, whether or not that when Hagar was basically, you know, threw Yishmael to the roadside and said, "I'm giving up." And then the angel comes and says, "No, here's water," right? Her eyes opened up. So the question the Mefarshim deal with there, not really a fundamental machlokas, but it's an interesting thing nonetheless, was the well already there? Did Hashem create the well? Or was it already there? Why would you say it was already there? Because the pasuk doesn't say that Hashem created a well. It says, "Vayifkach haseinah," that he opened her eyes. She really saw what she wasn't looking for. Because she thought she was so down, and she was down and out, and she was thirsty, and there was nothing she could do. She wasn't even comprehending what she could see. It was sort of like a mirage, if you will. She saw nothing. And that's Vayifkach haseinah. We talked about this between Mincha Ma'ariv a couple months ago already, by the bracha of Pokeach Ivrim, where although the literal understanding is people who are blind and Hashem allows them to see, it could also be a reference to all of us. Because we're also in some ways inattentively blind. When we don't focus on things, when we don't recognize things, we don't appreciate things that are right in front of us because of certain focuses on other things or certain ignorances that we have. So definitely possible that this is a concept of Hagar and it's the concept of Pokeach Ivrim. So that's the Pasuk Yud Tes. Now let's go into Pasuk Chaf Aleph and Chaf Beis, which is the end of Perek Beis, the end of the second chapter. Why should you stay away from her? Why should wisdom protect you from her? What's Pasuk Chaf?
I don't know.
Oh, I cut it out. I just said, yeah. So the truth is that the Pasuk Chav is a general Pasuk. L'man telech b'derech tovim, in order to go in a good way, v'archos sadikim tishmor, and in order to guarantee or to protect the way of the righteous. There is an interesting point here that there's Derech Tovim, which is general, and then there's Archos Tzadikim. We talked about this briefly a few weeks ago, that Derech is a general phrase and Orach is a specific phrase. That Derech means you're generally doing good things, and that's what it says, Leman Telech B'Derech Tovim, in order to walk in generally good ways. But if you want to be a Tzadik, you want to be righteous, that requires Archos Tzadikim. That requires doing specific things. And there are Gemaras about this, but I didn't have much to say, which is probably why I forgot to put it on. The Pesukim then continue, Ki Yisharim Yishkenu Eretz Usmimim Yevasriba. That the people that are straight, the people that go straight, will be Yishkenu Eretz. They will dwell in the land, they will sort of be able to live there, Usmimim Yevasriba. And the complete ones will... will remain there, like Yoter. They're the extra. They'll stay there. So what's interesting about this pasuk is that there are clearly two clauses, clearly two groups of people, but the Malbim and the Gra disagree about which one's better. The Gra says Yesharim means those people, and we've seen this before in pasuk Zion. We had the pasuk of Yitzpon la Yesharim Toshia, Magain laHolchei Tom. Which one is better, the Yesharim or the Holchei Tom? And in both places, I didn't pick up on the first time, but both places, the Malbim and the Gra disagree. The Gra thinks Yesharim are those people that are able to always stick to the path, no matter what situation they're in, because they have that internal compass. They have that way of understanding the world. They have sort of developed their own understanding of the Torah, their own sort of Das Torah. They're able to approach any situation. And in this situation, the Gra says that they're the ones that go out to the Melchamas. They take on the risks. They take on the fight. And they're able to overcome any obstacle, any risk, because they have that compass. However, says the Gra, Smimim Yivasriba. But the other people that are simple, like a Tam, a simpleton, he always stays away from risk. He stays away from anything dangerous. He doesn't want to get into wars. He'll say, I'm going to just dive in here. I'm going to learn over here. I'm not going to branch out. I'm not going to meet new people. I don't want to get involved in anything. So that's what the Gra says. Yesharim Yishkenu Aretz. They're going to actively dwell in the land. They'll be there. It'll be theirs. They will dwell there. Like a Shochein, you're going to dwell there. But Tamimim, those who are simple, just simple faith with Hashem, it's good. They'll be in the land, but Yevasribam, they'll happen to be there. They'll just be left over there. They'll remain there. But they won't be Shochein there. They won't really be entrenched in the land.
Occupying the land.
The Malbim, on the other hand, says it the other way. The Malbim says, Ki Yesharim Yishkenu Aretz, that the people that go on the straight path, they're going to just be going on the straight path. They just keep it simple. They go straight. And they're going to Yishkenu Aretz. They're going to stay there, and they'll be able to live there. But Tamimim, Yivasruba, no matter what happens, they're always going to be there. They will always remain there. This is how the Malbim reads it, right? The Gra read it as like, yeah, they're the leftovers. The Malbim says, no, they will always be. They will remain there no matter what happens. The Tamimim are the people with complete faith. Tamim tiya im Hashem elokecha. As the Malbim says, a tamim is someone who always goes with Hashem no matter what the situation. So they understand complete opposites, and they understand it within the words. That Yesharim Yishkenu Aretz could either mean they're going to be a shochein, they're going to literally be entrenched in the land, they're going to take their stake of the land, and Tamimim means they're just going to happen to be there. Or like the Malbim says, no, Ki Yesharim Yishkenu Aretz, they'll be there for a little bit, but they might end up leaving. They might end up losing it. But Tamimim Yivasriba, they will always remain there. It's very interesting how you can read the pasuk in completely opposite ways. Urisham he'aretz yikaresu uvogdim yisachu mimena, and the evil people will be cut off from the land, and those who betray will be uprooted from the land. Also has a certain progression to it, that the people that are evil will never be part of the land. Yikaresu, they'll be cut off completely. But the bogdim aren't completely evil, they're betrayers. Meaning once upon a time, they were with the right side, but they'll be yisachu mimena. They will be uprooted from it. What I find interesting about this pasuk is all four of these verbs, yishkenu, yivasru, yikaresu, and yisachu, are all in the future. They all will happen, right? The person that is yashar, he's going to, in the future, be shochin in the land. The tamim, he is going to remain there. The rasha, he is going to be cut off. And the boge, the betrayer, is going to be uprooted. All of these are posed in the future tense, meaning they're all long-term consequences. And specifically when it comes to this woman that we started with, who is trying to appeal to your desires, that's an in-the-moment appeal. It's happening in the moment. She's trying to convince you to do something right then and there. But if you would think about it, if you would pause, you would think about the long-term effects of cohabiting with a woman who's not your wife, who is obviously promiscuous. So then you would obviously think that the long-term effect is damaging enough to not get involved in this. So presumably when Shlomo HaMelech finishes his parak and says, the future consequences or the future reward will be based on how you decide in the moment. It's about whether or not you can understand the long-term. And in this, I just found one random study that I think is actually very interesting to this distinction of the Gra. And then with this, we'll close. Obviously, there was an experiment by G.W. Ainsley, in the 70s, I think, already, that says the following. This is just a summary. Pigeons were given a small, immediate food reinforcement for pecking a key. Right? They hit it, they got food. And a larger, delayed reinforcement for not pecking this key. Meaning if they didn't touch it, they'd get more food. Most subjects, what?
But they'd have to wait.
Most subjects pecked the key on more than 95% of trials. However, when pecking a differently colored key at an earlier time prevented this option from becoming available, 3 of 10 subjects consistently pecked it. Meaning the keys weren't there yet, but they had the opportunity to not have the key come. Meaning you take the option away completely. So 3 of the pigeons decided to take away the key so that they didn't have the option, the temptation to get the food right away because they knew that later on they'd get more, thereby forcing themselves to wait for the larger reward. They did not peck the earlier key when it did not prevent this option. Right? If there was no benefit to it, then they wouldn't do it. That was just the control setting. This is an experimental example of psychological impulse and a learnable device to control it. But what's interesting, so what is that learnable device to control it? What was that learnable device? If you had to think about it. Right? Take away the temptation. So which one, if I were to ask you, which one of the Gra's examples or the Gra's paradigms is that? Is that the Yashar or is that the Tamim? Is that the person that takes the fight head on or is that the person that avoids risk? It sounds like the one that avoids risk. So what's their conclusion? The conclusion is you can overcome your impulse if you just avoid the situation completely. This is what we like to call the short, long way. Get rid of the risk and ultimately you won't have to deal with it. But down the road, when you see a different situation and it has another impulse that's going to be appealing to you, you're not going to be able to withstand that. The long, short way to really work at it. The best way to conquer that and to attune yourself to avoiding those situations or to making the right decisions is, as the Gra said, to be a yashar, someone who has that moral compass. And this is how we're going to finish, based on what Shlomo HaMelech was saying all this entire parak, that it's not just about chachma in terms of analysis, sitting in front of a book and learning literal chomer, the material, but it's actually about imbibing it within your own persona to calibrate a compass which will be able to encounter any situation no matter what the risk. You'll be a yashar. And you don't need to take yourself away from risk. You'll be able to hit it straight on. Obviously, everyone on their own level figures out what risks they can manage, what they can't. Hopefully, ultimately, we'll all be able to become yesharim and we'll be able to be yishkon va'aretz. We'll be able to, you can be tum until then for certain things and figure out your own calibration until we can take Shlomo HaMelech's wisdom to heart, literally. Okay. Shkayach. Until next week, we'll have to continue with Perek Yomo, which, by the way, is perhaps the most chock full of famous sayings of Mishlei, so you'll probably notice some of them, maybe not next week, but in the weeks to come afterwards. So you don't want to miss it. I'll see you then. Yabadana.